the Michaud Mission, two men, one podcast, every black film ever made. My name is Len, a.k.a. the Bat Tribble. And as always, I am joined by my partner.
Hey, this is Vincent Williams.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we are continuing down the month of April, which means it is officially adorned as Octavia April, where the Michaud Mission takes time to celebrate Afrofuturism and the great Octavia Butler by looking at great films of black science fiction. Last week, we watched The Creator, which starred John David Washington.
Yes.
This week, we are watching his daddy.
That's right.
Do his thing from 2010 in the Hughes Brothers, The Book of Eli.
Yes.
Vincent's selection for this stop on the Michaud Mission. Shout out to each and every one of you out there watching as we are streaming live from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace right here in Manayunk, to all points north, south, east, and west. That means Facebook, that means Twitter, and that also means YouTube. Shout out to each and every one of you out there in the chat as we are streaming live. Hello, missionaries.
Good evening, one and all.
Vincent, how are you doing today?
I am fine. As people can tell, it's warm here in Philadelphia.
It is.
Yeah, so it's nice. I'm not going to claim spring yet, but it was a nice day.
It was a very lovely day.
And yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I had a very restful day after a very exciting weekend.
Right.
Hunkered down with a lot of my friends and my family, and including my grandson and son-in-law, to watch WrestleMania.
I'll say it was WrestleMania weekend.
Yes, WrestleMania here in Philadelphia, ladies and gentlemen, which meant that I did the smart thing and went out of town to watch WrestleMania.
It's real talk.
To Cherry Hill, where we rented like an Airbnb.
Yeah.
We all kind of like sat down and chill. It was a good time.
It was a
really great time. I had a good time seeing my grandson. First time I'd seen him in a couple of months since I went out to Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And my first time seeing my son-in-law, because he was always deployed every time that I saw him.
All right. Thank you for your service.
So it's a good time to be able to spend some time with him.
Okay.
And really just him and my grandson and like my best friend and a bunch of my best friends and a couple of my family and nephews and little niece who loves wrestling just as much as everybody else.
Nice, nice.
It was really, really a great time. And I don't know how many of our missionaries are Michaud Mission fans, but it really had a touch return back to my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
In that the champion Roman Reigns, he lost.
Yes,
in WrestleMania, lost the championship to Cody Rhodes.
Cody Rhodes, that's a familiar name.
Yes, the son of Dusty Rhodes.
Oh yeah, hard times.
But Roman Reigns had the longest. I had no idea of this.
Mm-hmm.
The longest reign of champion.
Okay.
Which extended over 4 years.
Okay. All right.
My nephew, William, who is 8 years old, is a huge wrestling fan.
Mm-hmm.
So since he really could really understand what he was watching, Roman Reigns was his champion.
It was his Hulk Hogan.
That was his, exactly.
That's his Hulk Hogan. Absolutely.
So when Roman Reigns lost, you know, everybody's like, oh, my God, you know, it was a great match and everything like that. We noticed that William had gone off into the corner and he was bawling his eyes out.
Sure,
And his father, you know, my nephew Jamal went over there and he's like, what's going on? I said, but he's crying because of Roman Reigns. That was his champion.
Sure, sure.
And sure enough, he was, man. And it took me back to my childhood because that's probably when I was into wrestling in my childhood. And it wasn't so much about the champion, but my favorite wrestler was Ivan Putski, who was the Polish Hammer. He was just this little Polish guy who just beat people up. And every time I would watch wrestling on Saturday afternoon, he would win a match.
Sure.
And then just around the rise of Hulk Hogan starting to percolate a little bit.
Sure.
Ivan Putski is in the ring against some guy, but he's like the big bad guy of wrestling. And this guy beats Ivan Putski to a pulp.
Okay.
And I was bawling my eyes out, especially because after that, Ivan Putski, who had been around for years, was no longer like a star. So mm-hmm. he just became like the guy that got everybody over.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, this is not fair.
Sure.
And that's kind of woke me up to what wrestling was really all about. So I felt for William in that moment.
Now, I don't want to do too much down this rabbit hole, but like I'm one of the people that really start watching wrestling during the Vince McMahon reign.
Okay, so during the Hulk Hogan.
During the Hulk Hogan and
yeah, because Ivan Putski is definitely a little bit before that.
Right, and if you know anything about wrestling, you know part of the Vince McMahon thing is he basically centralized it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like there are all these regional wrestling
situations. He took all the best
situations.
People. Yep.
Were you a fan before McMahon? Like, was there a regional kind of Philadelphia wrestling circuit that you liked?
I think there was a circuit, mm-hmm. but I was definitely a fan before McMahon really centralized it.
Okay.
But his wrestling was still my wrestling.
Okay.
So there wasn't if there was a Philadelphia centralized thing, they didn't have a TV presence.
Okay, which was going to be my next question.
Right. So Philly wrestling didn't get a TV presence until ECW, mm-hmm. which was much years later.
Sure. So, okay. I'm at this.
Was there a Baltimore kind of deal?
Well, I was not a wrestler. That was not my nerddom. Yeah, about to say is as seasoned nerds, like we've traveled these nerd lands. We've been around long enough to know that there's different types of nerditry.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
And while I only, I do what I do, I have respect for other. And I love the stories and the lore. And I know enough about wrestling to know that it is a pre and post Vince McMahon era.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious if I had stumbled into somebody who?
No.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, excellent. Okay. Glad it was a good time.
How was your weekend, Vincent?
Great weekend. We actually went and saw The Wiz.
Really? In New York?
In New York. Yeah.
On Broadway.
Yeah. Nice. It is in the previews right now. And my daughter Camille is a Wiz person and got us on some kind of list. And you know, they're doing the previews. And we went. And it was spectacular.
Wow.
Like spectacular.
Now The Wiz, which just, like you said, it's in previews.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't Wayne Brady in that?
Wayne Brady is The Wiz.
Okay.
Deborah Cox plays Glinda.
Okay.
And then it's a Broadway cast.
Okay.
And it is directed by Shel Williams,
mm-hmm.
and then it has some additional dialogue and sort of language by Amber Ruffin, the comedian, writer, Amber Ruffin, and it was spectacular.
Really?
Like I, you know, in full disclosure, I had medium expectations.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know. It's like, you know, well, first and foremost, you know, I am unapologetically a Wiz the movie guy.
Yes, you are.
So, you know, the fact that it's just on stage and this, that, and the other. And part of what made it work so well,
mm-hmm.
is that they kind of embraced the stage-iness of it. Like I think when you think about, or at least me.
Okay.
Because, you know, again, I saw a high school production of The Wiz, but like I've never seen it on stage. So when I think about The Wizard of Oz stuff,
you're thinking about the movie.
I think about The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
I think about The Wiz.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I did see Wicked.
Okay.
Which was a big. So I think intrinsically The Wizard of Oz is like a big kind of Cecil DeMille production.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't prepared for, frankly, like the level of intimacy that this production had. Like, I think at any given point, maybe there were 15 people on stage.
Wow.
Like, you know, just, you know, the City of Oz and the Scarecrows. But it really kind of dug down into the talent that you could see. Something that, and there was an interview with the cast on CBS Sunday Morning this past weekend that I watched, and they were talking, you know, Amber Ruffin and Shell Lewis were talking about sort of how they approached the material and this, that, and the other. And one of the things that they talked about is, and frankly, I think they picked this up from the movie, that when you think about The Wizard of Oz and frankly, the sort of traditional way the Wiz is created, it's like Dorothy is young.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then she's got like these three, you know,
old men,
weird uncles, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that changes the dynamic in the movie is that Diana Ross is basically Pierce.
Yes.
And she's actually older than Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's almost like a group of friends. And in this production, the cast is closer to the age of Dorothy. So like they're all kind of young. And it really has this kind of pop dynamic.
So they play them young.
They play them young. They okay. play them young. Okay. And then, you know, it's this wonderful sort of dialogue about you get a little background. Like, you know, just, you know, like they all talk about, you know, the Scarecrow, the Lion and the Tin Man all talk about they have families.
Oh, really?
And part of this curse that Eveline has put on them is separating them from their families.
That's a lot more fleshed out.
Yeah, it's a lot more fleshed out. But the set design, the costumes, mm-hmm. you know, one thing they do, you know, you think about the Wiz, it's always like this kind of exaggerated New York.
Yeah, cityscape.
They kind of move it to New Orleans.
That's smart.
So it
that's smart.
Right. So I cannot recommend The Wiz enough.
So moving it to New Orleans, they lean on that aesthetic.
They lean into it like it's this wonderful moment. Like, you know, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with The Wiz, when they get to Oz, there's this wonderful, you know, the color is green. Mm-hmm. And in the film and in versions, you know, like just from what I've seen on stage, they almost play it like a disco.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with this, they kind of do that. And then The Wiz comes on and says, yeah, that's nice. But can you do something? Can I get a little something extra? And then they do some New Orleans bounce.
Nice.
And they kill it.
Nice.
So it was spectacular.
Wow. The Wiz.
The Wiz.
I have been wanting to see that. And I remember when I went to see Pearly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like, oh man, I gotta go see The Wiz when it comes out. And it kind of like just got lost. And so I'm glad to hear that it came up.
Sure, because you know, I mean, look, I think I'll speak for myself. I think you kind of think, all right, you've got like the legendary Broadway uh-huh. one and everything with that. You've got The Wiz, the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm good. Like, I got The Wiz. And every single cast member did something to make the role their own.
Which is smart because
it's very smart.
Because you talk about the legendary Broadway run, which mm-hmm. was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the film, which was back in the 70s.
Yes.
So now you're talking about 50-year-old productions.
50-year-old productions.
And one of which, if you weren't there live, you really weren't there.
Right.
You didn't see it. Maybe you owned the album.
Right.
But and as right. much as that tries to approximate, it's not the real
right.
deal. And the movie, you know, your mileage may vary on the movie, mm-hmm. but it's still a 50-year-old movie.
Yeah.
But this is a story with historic music in it that is worthy of being something that is there for everybody.
Yes.
Everybody should have their Wiz.
And there's a vibrancy. There is an energy. This is not a period piece.
Mm.
This is not a museum installation.
Okay.
Like this is, right. This is a Broadway show. And you know, it's sort of like the thing. To be clear, I was surprised at how good it was just because I didn't know how the material mm-hmm. was going to transition. Like at this point, I'm never ever surprised at how good the performers are at a Broadway show. Cause you
don't know,
like you got to figure like it was 500 people in the room. fighting to the death.
That's right. For this role.
For this role.
Mm-hmm.
So like, dude came out and now I'm the Tin Man and it's 499 dead bodies in that room.
Yeah.
Somebody seated at.
Yep. Yep. And of least of which 100 of them probably are as good as this person.
Right. He was just a little quicker on the draw.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, they just didn't have that fastball that day. You know what I mean? So shout out. Shout out. Farrell Blackwell is asking in the chat, wasn't there a live version of The Wiz from a few years ago on television?
There was. Now, see, I was trying to see. That was, you know, my mother used to say, if you don't have nothing nice to say. Yes, there was.
You're correct. Moving on.
Moving on.
So check that out. Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to dig right into the show. And that means we're going to start off hearing from you, your emails, or as we like to call them,
missives from the missionaries.
So what else is going on, Lynn?
We have emails, Vincent.
Ooh, missives from the missionaries.
This is from the missionaries. Vincent, we have an email from Bruce Woods.
Hey, what's up, Bruce?
Saying thanks for the recommendation. I do know that ultimately both of you decided that you did not recommend The Creator.
Yes.
Our review from last week.
Yeah.
Bruce continues. I just wanted to let you know that based on your critique, I am sitting here watching this film.
Oh, okay.
So much detail went into your criticism and analysis of the film, I became intrigued with it. So I sit here watching a film that I would not have prioritized on my viewing calendar. Wish me well.
It's not a bad film, Bruce. You know.
Quick points. Is Intergalactic a brilliant presentation of modern day culture and romance on your list? I'd love to hear your take on this. Are you familiar with Intergalactic?
I am.
That's I don't know. I've never heard of
it. It's the Netflix animated film with Jessica Williams, who I go to immediately because I love Jessica Williams, and one of them little rat boys. One of them. I am fully embracing my middle-aged black man status. One of them little rat boys.
Okay,
look it up. So missionaries, Intergalactic. It was a cartoon and it was on Netflix a few years ago. It's a romance. I actually have heard really good things about
Kid Cudi.
Kid Cudi. It's Jessica Williams and one of them little rat boys.
Kid Cudi, who I wouldn't necessarily say is one of them little rat boys, but
hey,
okay.
Hey. If you made music after Enter the 36 Chambers, you want them little rat boys.
A whole lot of little rat boys then.
It is. And why is the music so loud? Look, write this down. Bobby Womack. Go ahead. Put on some Bobby Womack. Now you got something. We got something.
Okay.
All right.
All right. I think I did hear about this movie. I didn't see it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be good though. Yeah, I just haven't gotten around to it.
I didn't see it.
And I really like Jessica Williams.
Well, then maybe it might.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Its way. Also, on the subject of is it a black film, Bruce continues, the Australian film Rejoice that centers around three Aboriginal sisters from the late 90s who reunite after the death of their mother. The film does combine stuff we've seen before, mirroring other films that feature disparate family members coming together, the one that stayed home, and the racial issue that they experience.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, I'm starting a begathon regarding your podcast. A begathon.
Ooh, a begathon. All right.
I realize that I don't have anyone who I can discuss topics such as Len hate.
That's a whole subject, apparently.
The whole subtopic.
They have like a wiki. Stuff that Lynn Webb hates.
You know what? I know someone is actually working on a Wikipedia page for the Michelle Mission. If I see a Len hate subtopic, it's going to be me and you, bruh.
Things Len hates.
Or whether Origin read more like a documentary reenactment than a screenplay.
Ooh.
Keep up the great work. Bruce Woods.
Thank you, Bruce. I will say I'm not familiar with that Aboriginal film he's talking about.
Rejoice, no, me neither.
It sounds interesting.
Definitely does.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Bruce.
Got another email from Erica Washington.
Hey, what's up, Erica?
I'm a longtime missionary, but this is my first time writing to you. I believe I've listened to at least 80% of the episodes, and I've recommended your podcast to many people over the years.
Thank you, Erica. Appreciate that.
Thank you. As a fellow podcaster who hosts two shows, Sticky Note Conversations and American Dreams, Reproductive Justice.
Okay. Right on.
So I can appreciate the amount of work and time that takes to produce a weekly show, and y'all have been doing it for years. Amazing. I'm so appreciative of your review of Origin.
Okay.
The movie was profoundly moving and taught me a great history lesson. I immediately went out and purchased the book Deep South, written by the young couples portrayed in the film. I'm a huge fan of anything Ava DuVernay does, but the creativity it took to get this film produced and shown is a story in itself.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah, absolutely.
As I was searching through episodes, I didn't find a review of 1001 starring Tiana Taylor. I saw this at the theater and was so moved by her performance and the entire story. I would love to hear what you both think. If you ever decide to pluck a guest host from the Missionary Stand Club, put me in, coach.
All right.
Thanks for your commitment to this show and making me laugh consistently, Erica Washington.
Thank you, Erica.
Thank you, Erica. We really appreciate that. And I invite you missionaries to check out both of our podcasts, Sticky Note Conversations and American Dreams Reproductive Justice. I did not get a chance to check out American Dreams. I did check out a little bit of Sticky Note Conversations. I have to return because I have stuck a note that I like this podcast. I'm going to have to check it out.
And I've not seen Tiana Taylor's
1001.
But I've heard nothing but good things about it.
So I have heard great things about it. And it is more than on the list, Vincent, because Erica has given me an opportunity to let you know, ladies and gentlemen, that we are, as we have sprinkled in there, we are on our way to episode 400 of the Michaud Mission. And I will announce right now, as Vincent looks at me with dead eyes, ready to kill me, that episode 400 has been booked and will be, in fact, 1001, starring Tiana Taylor. And joining us for that review will be longtime missionary fan and frequent host here on the Michaud Mission, our good friend Dorian Missick.
Dorian Missick
will be joining us for episode 400 as we sit down to review 1001.
Very much looking forward. It's been good seeing him, too. You know he's on the circuit.
I know.
Because Shirley. Yeah.
So it'll be really great to sit down and talk with him. And actually, it'll be the first time in a long time sitting down and talking with him seriously about a movie.
I know. When you said it's so weird because it's always, like the last few times we were sitting talking about Dolomite.
Yes.
Which is awesome. But yeah, that'll be a good time.
It'll be a very good time. So we're looking forward to that. Yeah. So that is tentatively scheduled to hit the airwaves in June. Way things work. I don't want to put out the date just yet.
Look.
But episode 400.
Y'all saw me looking at it. I was like, ooh, Lynn, it's early April.
Hey, I booked it already. You got to get the man early.
Look, I hear you.
You got to put it out there.
All right. All right, but thank you. Thank you, Erica.
Thank you, Erica. Appreciate that. Hey there, missionaries. You know that Vince and I, we love you.
We do.
And we're glad that you come to the show every week. It would be a huge help if you could do us a favor and head over to Apple Podcasts and review the show. I know, it doesn't seem like it's a lot, but trust me, it helps other people find our little mission.
Absolutely.
So head over to Apple Podcasts, type in the Michaud Mission, and rate and review.
Thank you.
We have another email, Vincent. This is from Corey P.
What's up, Corey?
Black Directing School is the subject. Hi, Len and Vince. I hope this email finds you well. It did. I remember one episode you guys crafted an ideal criteria for black films for people to see. If you are either new to black cinema or an overall fan of black movies.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to that one episode prompted me to think about black directors and craft imaginary classes for people who want to check out black cinema since they've never watched any black movies before, wanting to pursue a career of filmmaking, or fans of black cinema in general. What would that look like? And what would be, or who would be, the black directors and classes you would like to see happen? Examples are Spike Lee pushing the envelope and incorporating motifs into film. Ernest Dickerson, cinematography. Barry Jenkins, masculinity and black love in a modern landscape. Cheryl Dunier and Dee Rez, black LGBTQ plus representation. Carl Franklin, neo-noir in black movies. I think that's a good one. Leslie Harris, black girlhood in films. Comedians wanting to direct for the first time. Can't wait to hear your thoughts from a fellow missionary, Corey P. I think all of those are actually really strong.
Corey hit a lot that I would hit.
He did. Cheryl Dunier and Dee Rez about black LGBTQ representation is good, but I would push back on that a little bit, especially in regards to Dee Rez.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Dee Rez could actually be pulled actually for any one of these, you know, from pushing the envelope and incorporating motifs.
Mm-hmm.
Or talking about black love in a modern landscape,
mm-hmm.
Even masculinity, you know,
yeah.
Thinking about, you know, some of the portrayals in Mudbone.
Yeah.
But I think you're the academic.
I mean, here. Someone named, you know, she name checked Ava DuVernay earlier. I think at this point you can absolutely have an Ava DuVernay class in sort of, art and activism.
Yeah.
You know, art and activism. Ryan Coogler and the way he kind of straddles sort of blackness and it's sort of almost a populism. Like I think he, like between Creed and the Black Panther films, like the way he's kind of thread the needle between this is something that has this distinctive blackness to it,
mm-hmm.
but it also has this quote unquote crossover appeal.
Okay.
Without losing its essential blackness. You know.
I think Jordan Peele.
I was just about to say Jordan Peele at this point.
I mean, Jordan Peele could actually, I mean, you could pull him on storytelling, writing, but I think him and maybe even Ava DuVernay, to your point, that move from being a filmmaker to a producer, you know,
mm-hmm.
because thinking about how many people they've brought up underneath them.
Right, right. Have you seen Monkey Man?
I haven't seen it yet.
Me either.
Yeah, I was thinking about maybe going to see it this weekend.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. You know, so many of these.
Monkey Man being a Jordan Peele
production.
Production, yeah, under Dev Patel.
Dev Patel's, yeah, movie. So, yeah. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That is a good one. Thank you, Corey.
Thank you, Corey, for that email.
Mm-hmm.
We have, I believe we have one more. Yes, okay. We do. And this is from Michael Lockett.
Hey, what's up, Michael?
The fabric of our lives ain't cotton.
Okay.
Happy live stream day, gentlemen. First, and apologize that I did not contribute to the conversation last week, but it was spring break and my family and I were out walking the soles of our feet off at the happiest place on earth. That's fine.
Hey, that's fantastic. You, bro. That's fantastic.
That said, I am all caught up on my tome travels, Just Another Girl on the IRT, Origin, Fences, and The Creator.
Okay.
In my opinion, Just Another Girl and the IRT, Origin and Fences all give us a slice of the American diaspora that, whether we like it or not, is us. In both Just Another and Fences, we get characters whom I think the directors went out of their way to make us not love, but definitely identify with in a very age-specific way. A teenager and an older man, weathered by life, can both be jackholes.
Mm-hmm.
I think Origin did a great job taking nonfiction and breathing some fanciful storytelling into it. The creator had all the makings of something great, but it dropped the ball when it came to everything but world building. Imagine how much better Allison Janney's role could have been had she had an equally powerful and nuanced foil.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree.
One thing that Vincent mentioned while you were giving your flowers to Louis Gossett Jr. was that he was part of the fabric of TV and cinematic culture. This got me pondering who you guys might put in the fabric conversation for the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, the 2010s, and the 2020s. There's so many names along the lights of Bernie Casey, Clarence Williams III, John Witherspoon, and Dougie Doug popped into my head. I had a hard time separating the wheat from the chaff, or to be more blunt, the AB list actors from the BC list actors who aren't ever going to lead, but certainly are steadily working because, well, they're part of the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
All the best, Michael Lockett.
Well, I'll say my neck goes all the way back to the late 80s.
Okay.
Up to this exact second. I think at this point, Jennifer Lewis is like just pure black seasoning in fabric. The, you know, I'll switch up the metaphor, in the soul food of black art. Like Jennifer Lewis, again, you always used to turn on stuff and see Jennifer Lewis.
Yeah.
Up until this moment.
Yeah, Jennifer Lewis is definitely a good one right there.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about your guy who you name check on almost every 6 degrees of Dervo Martin, Dick Anthony Williams.
Yeah, Dick Anthony Williams, who is like a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he'll play a senator. He'll play a pimp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's another person who probably until... I guess it's not recent anymore. It probably is now the last 20 years, but has made his way from fabric to becoming the stitch that holds the fabric together. And that's Samuel L. Jackson.
Samuel Jackson.
Because Samuel L. Jackson went from being just the guy that was in every movie to being the guy that is just in the lead in every movie.
You know, Samuel Jackson is fascinating to me in that conversation, because in my mind, he's like a perfect character actor, but he's just such a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
He can't help but kind of be in the lead now at this point.
Well, there's some actors that are like that.
Yeah.
There's some actors like Brad Pitt always, he says he considers himself a character actor.
Right.
Because he is a good actor.
Right, right,
but he's,
right.
You know, he's a leading star. Another person who I would mention, Loretta Devine.
Loretta Devine.
Yeah.
Loretta Devine. I'm so happy she's getting her flowers now. But Shirley Ralph.
Yeah.
Was a staple of black art all the way back to the 70s.
Yeah, she was. Now, here's my thing, not argument, but my question about Shirley Ralph, who I adore.
Of course you do.
Definitely a staple.
Mm-hmm.
But did she, because she spent more than a fair amount of time on stage.
Right, right.
So did she spend so much time on stage that she is not so much the fabric of film and television in that way?
I think arguably she spent as much time, if not more, on television now.
Really?
I mean, she was on Moesha.
Well, okay, Moesha. Okay, that's 90s.
Right. There were there are two or three shows in the 80s. Like, you kind of look at those, or at least I do. Like sometimes you go on YouTube and you look like short-lived shows that had like two or three seasons. Like, she was on, I think, It's a Living.
Oh, that's right. She was on It's a Living, like, on the syndicated version. Like, yeah.
Quietly.
Boy, that's a deep cut.
but that's what I mean. Like, yeah, quietly, yeah. You look at stuff and you go, damn, is that Cheryl Lee Ralph?
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I saw it, I was like, ooh, hey.
But it's like five shows like that. Where, just like you said, yeah, whoa, who's the brown shorty?
Yeah, oh boy.
And like in the credits, it says brown shorty.
It does.
Shirley Ralph.
It does. Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah. You just got me going back to this. It's a Living,
look, man. Look.
It's a Living. She played a waitress.
Look.
And like this it was like a penthouse restaurant.
It was the weirdest show. I think the conceit was these were women with jobs.
Yes.
It's 1982 and the women's movement's passed, and now women have jobs. Women have jobs. They've been able to get credit cards on their own for 5 years now. Women have jobs. Women have jobs.
It was nothing but young Alice. That's all it was.
Well, Alice's conceit was she had gotten a divorce.
That's true. That's right. That's right. Because Alice don't live here no more.
Making my way because I don't have no husband.
Okay. All right.
And
all
I got to raise.
We're going down theme song alley. Theme song alley. Let's not do that.
I'm going to be a waitress because I don't have a husband because I'm divorced. And then when Dad and Tom would come on afterwards, which had the exact same
premise.
Yeah, the exact same premise. High concept.
Yes.
She's a woman. She don't have a husband and she got three kids.
This is it.
What's she gonna do? She don't have no husband. Gotta go get a job.
Oh my God. I love One Day at a Time.
Look, man.
I did love that show.
Look,
I didn't like that show.
Look, you know what? Okay, and you know what? What was I reading? Like, I was reading something, like I was reading this essay on sort of pop culture and social movement reflected in the pop culture.
Okay.
And like, we've been talking about this sort of reaction to the women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because I was reading something about whiteness.
Mm.
And how ethnic whites had sort of become gentrified into like sort of standardized whiteness. And you think about something like
Okay.
So you think about something like there was this whole wave of shows like Angie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a million shows like Angie where like it was an ethnic white woman like, oh, she's Italian. Oh, she's Irish. And she marries like a waspy dude.
Yeah.
And then hijinks ensue because the wife has an ethnic family. It's like, oh, I'm really Irish. Oh, I'm really Italian. It's like, oh, I say.
Yeah.
But you know what they folded into that analysis?
Mm-hmm.
Bewitched.
Oh, really?
Where they said her, you know, not Sam? Samantha?
Samantha, yeah.
Samantha being a witch was sort of a metaphor of ethnic whiteness and sort of her trying to balance all of that. But yeah, it was a really interesting time, the early mid 70s into the 80s.
That's interesting because there was actually a show, and I'm trying to find it. It was a show starring Meredith Baxter Birney, when she was married to, at the time, David Birney, mm-hmm. the actor David Birney, right? And they did a show years ago called Bridget Loves Birney.
Okay.
That was a hit for one season, but it got taken off the air.
Because?
Because the premise of the TV show was that she was Catholic and he was Jewish.
So he was the ethnic.
Right.
And when you said it, and I was like, wait a minute, that sounds like he's Jewish.
Yeah.
You can't have an ethnic man.
This was like late 60s, right, early 70s. Right. And people, it was a hit.
Right.
But too many people started railing against it.
The woman can be ethnic. But the dude has to be, quote unquote,
regular. And this was probably right before they realized, okay, yeah, we got to switch this up.
It couldn't be no Italian dude with, like, Doris Day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is what makes I Love Lucy so radical.
Oh, well, yeah.
One of the many things that makes I Love Lucy so radical.
No. And timeless.
Yeah, and timeless. But, yeah, Shirley Ralph was always kind of in the mix in these shows. And, like, she was the black girl in it. So,
but you touching on Alice and One Day at a Time, especially One Day at a Time, gives me a segue to ask you.
Okay.
Have you seen the Netflix trailer for the animated reboot of Good Times?
I have.
And what are your thoughts on this reboot?
My mother told me that if you don't have anything nice to say, you shouldn't say anything. This is what I will say, all jokes aside. A, it's a trailer.
Fair.
B, there are people involved in it who I like work that they have done previously.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about before, but like the voices as well as behind the scenes.
Just the voices. Because let's be clear. I know some people were talking about old Carl Jones, who famously is one of the co-creators of the Black Dynamite cartoon, was involved in it. But Carl Jones cleared that up very quickly and said, I was not involved. Like, I was initially involved, but then we had creative differences and I left. But like Yvette, Nicole Carson, I think, the sister from Community.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, but I like her a lot. Mm-hmm. I think like Marseille Martin is in the mix.
Yes.
JB Smoove is in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are creatives that
Jay Farrow.
The creatives I've named. I'm not going. We're going to talk about. There are some people that I feel like they don't just take checks.
Okay.
So I do not have high hopes for it. I don't understand why this is, Yvette Nicole Brown. I don't understand why this is the project that people decided to focus their energy on. And I will say this, this did kind of depress me as a Good Times fan.
Mm-hmm.
Remember in the last episode of Good Times, JJ has gotten JJ sold Dyna Woman.
Right.
Which was his syndicated cartoon, which you assume is going to propel him into the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Keith has rehabbed.
Thelma's husband.
So now Keith and Thelma, because Keith is playing for the Chicago Bears and they've got an apartment down on Lakeshore. So now they're gone and doing their thing. Michael is in college.
Mm-hmm.
So you assume he's going to go and do his thing. If I heard correctly from the trailer, the father of the family refers to James as his grandfather.
Yeah.
Which means that he is the son
of one of them.
Of one of
the kids.
The kids. Which means that something didn't go right. That they ended up back in the projects.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of makes me sad.
That does.
So
it means that Keith's knee didn't hold up.
That means Keith's knee didn't hold
up. I mean, that's what it means.
I mean, quite honestly, let's be clear. I hated Keith from the moment.
We all hated Keith.
Is this who they gonna marry Thelma off to?
Made absolutely no sense.
His punk ass broke his. How you break your, like, dog? Are you a college football player?
Yeah, because
he break his leg tripping over JJ at the wedding.
That's what it was, right? Yes.
What kind of dumbass. Mr. Glass?
Mr. Glass.
Right.
Exactly what Keith was. Mr. Glass.
Then I don't know if he was about to graduate or he had graduated, but then like he couldn't get no job.
No.
Cause then he said, they taught me how to do foot. I do football. Didn't he? He was a drunk.
Well, here's the, see,
man, I hate it, Keith.
You're touching.
You have actually triggered me a little bit.
I apologize.
Yeah.
You're actually touching on like, you know, cause the feedback on our trailer has been immense online. And a lot of people are, you know, talking about how they're trampling over like sacred ground.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me be the first one to say it, and nobody else has told you. Good Times was an okay series. Vincent likes Good Times.
Yeah.
But there's nobody who will tell you that Good Times was really all that after the first three seasons. Right. After John Amos leaves the show, the returns on Good Time are few and far between.
You know what Good Times is? You want, let's just kill a couple of cows. Good Times is Star Trek, the original series.
Yep.
Where people remember like 10 episodes.
10 episodes.
And we all talk about them 10 episodes.
From the first two seasons.
But understand, it was a lot of episodes of Good Times.
Then there was a lot of episodes where it was just the kids.
Yeah.
It was just the kids in the house because Florida left for a minute,
Florida
too.
Florida left, yeah.
Because she said, I ain't got no time for this time foolishness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I will say about the trailer is that, you know, like you, there are a lot of voices on there. The ones you mentioned, Wanda Sykes is on.
Sykes, who right now is the creator of what I really think is the spiritual successor to Good Times, which is the Upshaws.
The Upshaws on Netflix.
Which is fantastic.
Which is the other show on Netflix.
Yeah.
But there are, and there's some people behind the scenes who, you know, at least you would think maybe have good intentions,
right,
if nothing else.
And some sense.
Yeah. What bothers me about this is that I don't really think that greatly highly of Good Times. First three seasons, I'll go to, boom. I can take or leave Good Times. But I do recognize its place in history.
Exactly.
As far as Black history.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Because of that, I have a problem with them taking that name, taking that piece of IP and attaching it to something that seemingly continues the downward spiral of the show from where it probably left in its last season, where it still tried to be good, but it was just, you know, is whatever. And now they have just gone, it has just gone someplace totally left. Mind you, that's totally based on the trailer.
We have not,
like you said, we have not seen that episode.
Right.
And because there are argument to be made that if you took a trailer of, you know, a lot of shows.
Sure.
Or a lot of movies and things, they might have you thinking one way and then the actual product taking you another way. So, but that being said, I would have just as soon as them just coming up with another title and letting this be its in and of itself, its own thing.
If you know what? Yeah, basically what you just said. Like, if you took the two words good times away from it, I think people would feel a little better about it.
Yeah. Because then you would feel like you have the license to maybe laugh at some jokes that maybe are kind of like a little funny.
Look, man.
You know?
Carl Jones left, apparently, but I would love that kind of Black Dynamite energy.
Oh, I would love it.
To be on something.
Black Dynamite.
Of course you did, because the Black Dynamite cartoon is one of the greatest things to ever happen in the past, like, 30 years to Black people.
Yes.
It's like we had a Black president, Black Dynamite. That's in it. That order.
That's it.
Black president, Black Dynamite.
That's it. And Jay Cargill.
I don't know what that is.
Look it up.
Why don't you just tell me?
If you watch WrestleMania, you know who Jay Cargill is.
Yeah. All right. All right. But yeah, you know, you going to watch an episode?
I'm going to watch it.
You're going to watch the whole thing?
I will try to watch a whole thing because I want to give it its just due.
I'm going to commit to two episodes.
I was going to say, I'm going to commit to two.
I'm
going
to commit to episodes, two episodes.
Because thinking that the first one is the pilot.
Sure.
And then
the second one kinda,
is after. Yeah. What did you learn from the pilot?
What have we learned?
Exactly. What have we learned? So I'm going to commit to two.
I'm going to commit to two. I'm also going to commit to two. That was the plan.
All right.
All right.
And before George Kimona asks.
Look, we got him.
Good times. Mm-hmm. Before you ask George Kimona, we are not going to be talking about Star Trek Discovery right now. We have promised at the end of the season, we will do a total deep dive on this season of Discovery
and Discovery the show in general.
In general.
Yes.
Okay. So cut you at the pass, my brother.
All right.
All right. All right. Let's continue on with the show, ladies and gentlemen. There is no top five tonight.
Mm-hmm.
No top five, but there is always the Game of Kings.
Game of Kings.
Which means it is time for 6 Degrees of Derville Martin. Six Degrees of Derville Martin, ladies and gentlemen, where I give Vincent two actors and he has six films or less to connect them to Derville Martin.
Mm-hmm.
That man from the 70s whose legend lives on in the 80s, the 90s, 2000s, the 2010s, and here.
And here forever.
In the 2020s. Right here. Vincent.
Yes, sir.
Keeping in theme. We are going to be reviewing The Book of Eli from the director, the Hughes Brothers, starring Denzel Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I've plucked two stars from The Book of Eli.
Okay.
You will have to connect them to Derville Martin.
I will.
And you cannot use The Book of Eli.
I cannot use The Book of Eli.
No, you cannot.
Book of Eli, off the table.
So in six films or less.
Yes.
Connect Derville Martin
to
Mila Kunis.
Mila Kunis.
Hmm?
This is so lowbrow. Like, I know she's probably in something better than this, but I'll just go ahead and say, Derville Martin is in 5 on the Black Hand Side with Dick Anthony Williams, who is in Mo Better Blues with Denzel Washington. We can't go back to Book of Eli, however, but Denzel Washington was also in, Devil in the Blue Dress with Jennifer Beals, but I can't use Jennifer Beals to go back to The Book of Eli either.
No, you cannot.
But he was also in Devil in the Blue Dress with Don Cheadle.
Okay.
And Don Cheadle was in Boogie Nights.
Yes.
With Marky Mark.
Yes.
And Marky Mark was in Ted with Mila Kunis.
Ah, I forgot she was in Ted.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't thinking that one.
Yeah.
Ah, spoiled again by the great brain of Vincent.
Yes. And the fact that he has this space for lowbrow humor. Can I tell you how ashamed I am? Do you know I barreled through the Ted prequel series?
Really?
Like 2 days.
Because you liked it that much?
That dumb ass show. Made me laugh so hard. And I felt bad about myself. It was lowbrow, kind of 12-year-old humor. But boy, Seth MacFarlane's deep voice coming out that little bear saying profane things.
That was everything you wanted.
It just cracks me up.
Everything you wanted.
Look, I'm ashamed of myself how much I like Ted.
You know, Seth MacFarlane is one of the producers on the Netflix Good Times.
Yes. That tracks, actually.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
All right.
All right. Very good, right. Vincent.
Yeah.
All right. Next.
Mm-hmm.
It's six films or less. Connect Derville Martin to.
To.
Another star from The Book of Eli.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Gambone.
Michael Gambone. This is a little bit of a cheat because I kind of knew you were going to pull him and I didn't know who he was. But then I saw he was in all Harry Potter movies.
Mm.
So I'll get to him.
Now, when you say a Harry Potter movie, you got to say the full name.
Harry Potter in the Deathly Haunts. Harry Potter in the You Call Yourself a Woman, But I'm Not Gonna Call You a Woman, and Y'all Gonna Take My Transphobic Stuff and Love Me Anyway.
Go.
Then all right, but he's in one of them later because he's in the right one with Alan Rickman, of course. And Alan Rickman is in the greatest Christmas film ever made, Die Hard, with Bruce Willis, who is in Die Hard with a Vengeance, with Samuel Jackson, who is in Mo Better Blues, with, of course, Dick Anthony Williams, mm-hmm. who gave Derville Martin a half-off in Five on the Black Hand Side.
That's very good, Vincent. However, I do want you to name...
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
You got to be able to name one.
Once you got past Sorcerer's Stone, I stopped paying attention to the names of the movies. Harry Potter is a grown-ass man. Harry Potter and everybody understanding that Ron should have died, but we all like Ron. Harry Potter and are we really just are okay. we watching these anymore or okay. are we just kind of making them and
okay
right
I should have took him Harry Potter
and the transphobe has made $1 billion and y'all gonna keep buying Harry Potter stuff.
If I take, I'm curious.
You gonna take this bigotry?
I'm curious.
Like, I love the fact that J.K. Rowling has just completely punked nerdity and geek world and I'm just a bigot and y'all gonna take this bigotry and keep doing Harry Potter stuff and I'm not gonna bite my tongue. And what you gonna do about it? Not do Harry Potter? And there's a whole generation of people that are like, I can't do Harry Potter. And then I'm like real quiet because I was like too old to really get hooked into Harry Potter like that. And I'm like, Dad, I'm glad the stuff I'm really into, all of them are dead. Like, Jack Kirby can't say anything terrible because he's dead. Although, from what we know about Jack Kirby, he was a good dude. He was a good dude, so.
Yeah. I'm curious. If mm-hmm. I had taken the Harry Potter films off the list,
would you
have been able to?
Probably not.
Really?
Okay. Right, because what would, I mean, I'm not, like, you see him and you know him, but, like, what would I have known him from and said?
I'm trying to think of looking at his film. Did you see The King's Speech?
No.
Okay.
No, I had no interest in that at all.
Okay. Did you see Gosford Park? No, not a Gosford Park fan. Didn't make your way to that. The prequel to Ted, you found it barreled through. Gosford Park, Academy Award nominated Gosford Park. Got no time for that. Okay. Interesting.
Complicated man. Gosford Park is 100% one of those prestige films that everybody talks about in the year that it's out and then nobody ever watches it again.
Oh, that's not true.
When is the last time someone watched Gosford Park and why did they watch it?
I watched Gosford.
No, not you weirdo old white lady sitting in the house eating soup. I mean, a regular person,
I don't like soup.
Because it's too hot. Is it too hot and spicy? You just want like some tea and you drop the tea bag in just for.
I do like tea.
Don't keep that tea bag in too long.
No, I don't keep my tea
bag. I know you don't because you like it sort of weak. And some dry toast.
No.
Maybe some applesauce.
No, I get a 4th Street cookie.
Uh-huh.
How's that spend my right. nights?
What else would I know him in?
This is a film I think you saw.
Okay.
Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Who was he in that? Of course, who was anyone in that?
Well, isn't that the movie with
I remember Angelina Jolie because she had an eye patch.
He plays Morris Paley.
Okay, sure.
I don't know.
All right.
I couldn't get through.
I did see Sky Cat. I can understand not getting through it, though, because it was weird looking.
He was also in Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow.
He is Baltus Von Tassel.
Yeah, like he's one of the, you know, like he's a great character actor that he's just sort of over there playing his position.
Okay.
So yeah, it really was. Yeah, I'm not even gonna lie and to you. I was leaning on Harry Potter.
He was in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
What did he play? That's my favorite Wes Anderson film.
I don't believe so. He was Osiri Draculius.
Now that's a good one. Now that's a good one. Yeah.
Is that a character role?
Yeah, yeah. But I love, like, that's one of my favorite films, quietly.
And yet you did not recognize him.
I didn't. I did. Well, I forgot. I don't think about him.
He's in that the same year that he's in a Harry Potter movie.
Okay.
You should be ashamed.
Yeah, okay. I'll learn to live with it.
I'm sure. All right. And Layer Cake. He was in Layer Cake.
I never saw Layer Cake.
Layer Cake is a good movie.
I hear that.
It's a good movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not as good as Gosford Park.
Oh, sure.
I honestly, okay, let me tell you this.
For Christ's sake.
Let me tell you this, Vincent.
Yes, yes.
Bear with me.
Yes, please tell me about this period piece, prestige film.
Vincent.
Bunch of baby boomer white people.
I believe that you will like Gosford Park.
Gosford Park.
Because
it's very important.
Because at his heart, it's a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a murder mystery. Mm-hmm. And Helen Mirren is in it.
Oh.
Clive Owens.
Oh.
You like them?
I do, but come on. Who else is in it? Who else very prestigious is it? Look at Clive Owens trying to make a prestige film. Who else is prestige in it?
He's good at what's this young boy's name?
Oh, sir,
not Ryan Gosling.
Sir Pippington Chauncey.
No,
Scottish Chaunceys.
You know, I hate when you do that. Bob Balaban
is in that movie? Oh, okay, I didn't know Bob Balaban was in it. Oh my goodness, I didn't know Bob Balaban was in it.
That's not who I was reading.
You should have led with that.
Not who I was reading for. Maggie Smith.
Oh, Dame Maggie Smith.
Dame Maggie Smith is in there. Really? And a very young Ryan Phillippe.
A very young Ryan Phillippe.
Yes. Yes. It's a good movie.
I'm sure it is.
Robert Altman wrote and directed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good movie.
No, all jokes aside,
he didn't write it. It was written by the creator of Downton Abbey.
Yes, but, yes. I did not know Robert Altman directed it.
It's a very...
And like,
it's
all jokes aside, you should have led with that.
Well, okay, well, we were on Michael Gambon.
Yes, yes, but yeah, there is nothing about Gosford Park.
You should see it.
Yeah.
You should watch it. Mm-hmm. I believe you will like it.
Yeah, sure.
Why don't we do a show together?
Because you love me. And I love you.
Yeah. Let's get to our review of The Book of Eli.
We'll be right back with our movie review after we step to these messages.
Ago, the war tore a hole in the sky. Only a few survived. Our only hope is in my hands.
Take off the pack, nice and slow.
Put that hand on me again, you won't get it back.
Cursed be the ground for our sake. For out of the ground we were taken, and to the dust we shall return.
I told you you weren't going to get that back.
This little town, just the beginning.
All we need is that book.
He's different than the others. You're not going to be able to make him do what you want him to do.
This is your last chance. Give it up or I swear I'll bury you.
I don't want any trouble.
That's too bad.
Nobody touches it but me, you understand me?
I love this guy. Shoot him, please.
Teach me.
Put a crew together, we're going after him.
Go back inside.
Close your eyes.
The Book of Eli, ladies and gentlemen, 2010 American post-apocalyptic neo-western, directed by the Hughes brothers, written by Gary Whitta, and starring Denzel Washington, Gary Oldman, Mila Kunis, Ray Stevenson, Jennifer Beals. In the cameo role, Michael Gambon. The story revolves around Eli, a nomad in a post-apocalyptic world who seeks to deliver his copy of a mysterious book to the West. Filming began in 2009 and took place in New Mexico. In this film, that is Vincent's selection for this stop in Octavia April on the Michaud Mission. Vincent, what say you of The Book of Eli?
The Book of Eli is a film whose name comes up when we have conversations about representation in science fiction. And certainly when we think about post-apocalyptic films as a subgenre of science fiction, you know, since 1985's Road Warrior. It is not a subgenre where, frankly, you see a lot of Black people. And when you think about the Book of Eli and you think about sort of what led to this film happening, it seems like a really interesting story of the development of this film. Starting with the Hughes brothers, who have had this fascinating career. You know, they're sort of introduced to all of us when they create Menace to Society, which
Albert and Alan, right?
Albert and Alan. And Menace to Society, talking about subgenres, you know, sort of the hood films of the 90s, is what many would argue, and I'm certainly one of the many, this is the best quote unquote hood movie. Like, this is the do the right thing of those hood movies. Like, you know, Boys in the Hood kind of started it, but Menace to Society perfected it.
Okay.
And certainly after the success, both commercial and critical, of Menace to Society, the Hughes brothers were well within their rights to say, this is what we're going to explore. This kind of modern LA, you know, South LA, you know, sort of Black people put this in, we'll just make films in this setting, be almost a Black Southern California Woody Allen almost.
Or Spike Lee.
Or Spike Lee, right. And this is where we're going to be. But then they bounce.
Yep.
And make a period piece that we've talked about, you know, Dead Presidents, which is one part coming of age, one part Vietnam film, one part heist film. And somehow that works. And you're like, okay, well, that's a little bit of a departure, but all right, I kind of see this connective tissue between these two films. And then the next major motion picture film they make is an adaptation of Alan Moore's graphic novel From Hell.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you're not familiar with it, From Hell is comic icon, comic genius Alan Moore's take on the Jack the Ripper story. And did you read From Hell?
Not all of it.
Yeah. You know why? Nobody really reads From Hell. Like, it's this brick.
Yep.
Of a graphic novel. It's like 1,000 pages. And it's like a fever dream where there's conspiracy theory. There's Alan Moore has moved into halfway being a magician.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing spells and he's doing all this stuff. And most people said that this was unfilmable. And after the Hughes brothers make this film, people continue to say
this is unfilmable.
This is unfilmable. And frankly, the film version of Most Hell of From Hell. Hell does not succeed at all.
No.
But it's a really spectacular failure.
Yes.
You get the sense that the Hughes brothers were trying to do something.
They're
going
for it.
They took a big swing.
Mm-hmm.
They missed, but they took a big swing. Mm. So just from these three, somewhere in there, they make a documentary about pimps. Like, they become these filmmakers that you pay attention to the projects they take.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're sort of all over the place. And you're like, well, there must be something interesting about this if they took this. Then you have this really A-list star, Denzel Washington, in the middle of it. And at this point, he's made Man on Fire. This is after Training Day. So Denzel Washington in action mode is not unique. But Denzel Washington as this mysterious traveler,
mm-hmm,
who's adept at these sort of combat martial arts, which, sidebar, you read Denzel Washington performed his own stunts.
Yes, he did.
That's actually Denzel Washington doing that. And kind of, traveling to the West with this book. It's not really a spoiler because you find out fairly early that it is a copy of the Bible that he's trying to deliver somewhere to the West. And Gary Oldman is playing a sort of one of these small town lords, that you see in these post-apocalyptic films. And much like Denzel Washington, if I haven't mentioned it already, sort of elevates everything.
Yeah.
Like Denzel Washington sort of elevates whatever material he has because he's Denzel Washington.
And the same for Gary Oldman.
Same for Gary Oldman. And Gary Oldman is sort of playing this role, and he wants the Bible because he's going to use it to manipulate religion and kind of take over. Rounding out the cast is Jennifer Beals, who is doing okay in whatever she's doing. Not that much. And Mila Kunis.
Kunis,
who I always like Mila Kunis.
Me too.
And I kind of like her energy with Denzel Washington. And this is a film, very well directed. It's kind of washed out, this kind of post-apocalyptic drought. And it's very dusty. It's a lot of browns. It's a lot of grays. But the Hughes brothers are good enough as directors that I never found it a monotonous landscape.
Mm-mm.
Like, it's always something really interesting to see. But I think what this film really stumbles on is a factoid with the script, where the script writer, Gary Whitta, talks about he wrote the script in 6 days.
Mm.
And certainly they brought in a screenwriter to punch it up. When you read about Denzel Washington and the Hughes brothers and Gary Owen and their kind of process, apparently a lot of them contributed to the script as well. But there's never a moment where this script really rises to the level of craft that everyone I just named is capable of. And you see in this. Mm-hmm. I think this script reminded me, like, every now and then I'll get like a student paper and it's like a 5-page paper. And it'll be like 2.5-3 pages of them writing, kind of, you know, I gotta get these pages. And then like at the top of page 4, they hit something really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I always circle like the topic sentence and say, this is where the paper should have started.
Mm.
But you spend all this time kind of spinning your wheels and doing this, that, and the other. And so much of this film is almost like a paint by numbers post-apocalyptic film. Like, if you're going to make a film like this more than 20 years after Road Warrior, you have to add something to it. Mm. And so much of the film is just sort of rote. It's dusty. It's Ducasio. Oh, you know, you got some interesting action sequences, but it's not really doing anything. Until there's a moment, and there's a moment where Mila Kunis and Denzel Washington's Eli go to a house and meet a couple.
Yes.
And then the film kind of has a bounce. There, mm-hmm. You know, there's
because that's Michael Gambon.
Michael Gambon, yes. There's a plot detail
mm-hmm.
that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually put in my notes, it gets to the point at the end and Malcolm McDowell shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I feel like if you had Malcolm McDowell in your hand,
yeah,
maybe you should have played this card
a little earlier.
A little early.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Like, I didn't know Malcolm McDowell was sitting over on the side.
Yeah.
So that in the last half hour, it gets the kind of bounce that I wanted for 2 hours.
Mm.
But I have to say, by the time I got to that bounce, I think it was, kind of too little too late.
Mm.
So that I landed on, I wish there was a sharper version of this. You know, so much so that even the plot detail that I'm talking about that makes you kind of re-examine the whole thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it was the script was too cute for its own good. And maybe that should have been, you know, kind of lead with that.
Mm.
And then you get something that I think is a little stronger than what we end up getting.
See, I think I like the idea you mentioning the filmography of the Hughes brothers and going through it. And especially when you land on Dead Presidents
mm-hmm.
and how many movie genres are wrapped up in that one film. You mm-hmm. know, the Vietnam, the coming of age, the heist film. It's all there. It's like they go for their epic movie right there. And one of the things that I'm always fascinated about in regards to the Hughes brothers, and even when you hear about, you know, sibling directing teams like the Wachowskis, is, you know, like, who's doing what?
Sure.
And whose creativity is being served on this film, mm-hmm. right? And you get the idea with the Wachowskis that there is a synergy creatively between the two of them so that every film feels like it's theirs,
mm-hmm.
right? But with the Hughes brothers, because there is so many what seem to be like opposing forces in their films, you feel like they're kind of like playing like, okay, we're going to give you a little bit of you here, and now this is going to be a little bit of me, and then wherever it meets in the middle is where it does. Because even with Menace to Society, as much as that is a hood film, there's a fair amount of romance in that movie as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of the coming of age in that film as well, as in most hood films.
Sure.
To be fair. So there's always like this juxtaposition of things, but through a lot of their films, there's always like this dark element which rides through all of their films, which is why when you heard that they were going to do From Hell, it seems like it might be a match made in heaven if they mm-hmm. can pull something out of the source material to put onto the screen.
Fever dream.
But one could argue that what they put on the screen is a fever dream.
Yeah, true.
It's a fever dream.
That's true.
I don't know how well it blends together, but you know, it has its fans. It's a movie that does have its fans. So in the Book of Eli, what I saw was, yes, them definitely going for this, the post-apocalyptic, you know, version. They're doing some of their riffs on Mad Max and
sure.
the Road Warrior, mm-hmm. things of that nature. But I also saw them leaning into another genre, which is, it's touched on a little bit in the Wikipedia post about it, in the Western.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I love that Ray Stevenson, who, you know, sadly, we lost not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Brilliant character actor, mm-hmm. and I've forgotten in this movie, and an actor who has a way of bringing a lot to what is really just a very small role, and he could definitely been paid by numbers, but he brings just a little bit of nuance to it. And one of the little touches that he brings to this is he's always whistling this tune, and the tune that he whistles is from Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America. Mm-hmm. Now, Once Upon a Time in America is not one of Sergio Leone's Westerns, but Sergio Leone is most famous for his spaghetti Westerns that star Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the man with no name, the man in the poncho. And Denzel Washington as Eli, who was only named three times in this film, mm-hmm. is kind of playing a similar role.
Sure.
You know, this lone traveler who comes into town and totally is like this disruptive force in the town, right? So I see those two genres, and he's trying to marry them. And they definitely are genres that taste great together, mm-hmm. a Western and a post-apocalyptic world, if you said it right. And you mentioned that it's brilliant in the decision to have this be like this washed out dystopia. They never hit it over the head as far as what happened.
Right.
But you see what you can kind of, there are enough context clues, mm-hmm. you know, from the nuclear ash that is falling down in the beginning of the film to Denzel or Eli telling Solara, Mila Kunis, about, you know, the story about how the sky opened up, mm-hmm. and this light came out, which is, you know, a metaphor for nuclear mm-hmm. explosion. So those forces kind of like marry well together, which I liked. And in the best of Westerns, to me, the story often is very bare bones. It is just basically got to do this, got to get to B so I can get to C. Mm-hmm. And that is very much what this movie is. So then, okay, what is the difference? The difference is the characters. The difference is whether or not you care about them. Right. And for me, I found myself caring about them. I cared about Eli. It's not so much that I cared about Eli, but I was with him.
Okay.
I was as much with him as I am with Clint Eastwood in any of his movies. Right. Mm-hmm. You figuring, you know, he ultimately is going to win, but you just don't know how it's going to look. And that's what happened with Eli. Mila Kunis, I've always been a fan of Mila Kunis all the way back to that 70s show.
Sure.
Where I just like, she's the one that for some reason
pops.
It's popping for me. Mm-hmm. And I've liked her in everything that she's done with it, whether it be drama or comedy. I like Mila Kunis. Gary Oldman, forget about it. The man is a beast. Ray Stevenson, come on. I like him. I like everything that is happening in this film. And I also like the idea of marrying in this kind of like poke or of Christianity into this movie without being super over drumming it, you know, beating it on its head. Mm-hmm. Right. Which I liked and leaned to for me a little bit more into Denzel Washington. I think it's very interesting that Denzel is doing this movie after Training Day, after Malcolm X. And Denzel, for those who don't know, and I don't know how many people knew it in 2010, is a fairly Christian man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So he's thought about being a preacher.
Right.
Publicly several times.
So this is one of those movies where, if not the first time, he kind of gets to like extol a little bit of that without, you know, like without putting it as a faith-based movie or mm-hmm. anything like that. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. And it doesn't even it doesn't land on Christianity, because the book, which is the Bible, at the end of the movie, when you see it's printed up, it's placed next to a Hebrew Bible.
Yeah. And a Quran.
Yeah. So it's really all about restoring, at its essence, it is about faith. Mm-hmm. Right. And Denzel Washington, Eli, he started off on this mission of faith, and where in any other Western, you know, you're waiting for them to be the big set piece at the end. Mm-hmm. That him getting his revenge. No, he does not go off his path. Mm-hmm. You know, stay on the path. That's the message about it. About the movie. And I appreciated that. I saw that as a little bit of a twist, mm-hmm. let alone the twist that the real big twist that comes at the end, which I guess we won't spoil. We haven't mentioned, so I'm not going to mm-hmm. spoil it. So much so that as I'm watching this movie and I'm enjoying it, this is maybe the third or fourth time that I've watched Book of Eli. And I've enjoyed it every time that I've seen it.
Okay.
But this time I'm really sitting there and paying attention to the cinematography, mm-hmm. paying attention to the direction, mm-hmm. loving everything the Hughes brothers are doing this. As much as I am a fan of Menace to Society and Dead Presidents, this may be my favorite Hughes movie.
Wow.
Loving Gary Oldman. I'm just a sucker for Gary Oldman.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this movie.
Okay.
I end up liking this movie, and my hot take from this movie
mm-hmm.
is that this may be my
mm-hmm.
favorite Denzel Washington performance. I'm not saying it's his best movie.
No, it's your favorite.
It's my favorite.
It's your favorite.
It's
okay.
My favorite performance. And I'll tell you why, because in Malcolm X, as good as he is in Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
he almost becomes Malcolm X.
Yes.
Right. And as much as I like Malcolm X, there's a part of me that believes that Malcolm X is, as great as it is, a little long,
mm-hmm.
a little bit too long. And thus his performance starts to like a little, you know, I could do, you know, like, all right, let's wrap this mm-hmm. up. Let's keep it moving. Fences, which we both enjoyed mm-hmm. Immensely. I like Fences. I do enjoy him in Fences. But there's something about this movie, especially in the beginning of this movie, where he almost is saying nothing.
Absolutely.
And he's on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he is at this midpoint in his career where he's definitely still the action star that he was becoming. Because I don't think he ever really leaned into action. Probably not until now when he's much older.
Yeah.
But he still had it in him. Mm-hmm. And he flexes it. He gets it in when he does everything. But he also is a seasoned actor. He doesn't feel like he has to be like this cut chiseled guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he lost weight for this film, but he's still a little soft, you know? And because there's no, almost his dialogue is very sparse in this film. There's not a lot of the Denzel isms in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his smile is barely present in the movie, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So his charisma is still on display, but his intensity is there. And the way that he connects with Solara, Mila Kunis's character, the way that he connects with Jennifer Beal in one scene together, I just really felt his presence in this movie. And maybe this is me reading a little bit too much into, you know, his Christianity, you know, playing a part in how he wants to really carry this role.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that there was a lot more of the actual Denzel in this that you hear so many actors speak of, where he's become like their mentor, this guy who's kind of like the sage advice. I felt there was so much more of Denzel in this role than in maybe any of his other roles that I really just really enjoyed it. And also I'm a sucker for a Western. So I think this is my favorite Denzel Washington performance. And because of that and all of the other factors, I just thoroughly enjoyed this movie. I enjoyed every aspect of it.
Yeah. God knows I wish I could be there with you. But I really do. I just thought this script was so by the numbers.
But isn't that every Western? And you love Westerns.
No, I do love, but not every Western is like, and certainly.
What's your favorite Western?
Old Clint Eastwood.
What, Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
No, old Clint Eastwood. He's old.
Oh.
Morgan Freeman.
Not that beloved. Unforgiven.
Yeah, Unforgiven.
Okay.
Unforgiven. And to your point where you mentioned that this sort of references the Man with No Name films and how they you know, in a lot of way were vibes.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, I agree with you that it pulls from those, and then it pulls, of course, from the post-apocalyptic films. But whether we're talking about the Man with No Name films from the 60s, early 70s, or again, you know, like Mad Max, of course, comes out before 85, but we really go to Road Warrior in 85. These are both films. These are both examples that are decades before this.
Mm-hmm.
So that in 2010, and certainly when I watch it today, like in full disclosure, part of the reason that this was underwhelming to me is because something that has happened since the first couple of times I watched it is that George Miller reminded you who he was.
Yeah, he comes back with
Mad Max Fury Road.
Right.
And again, something that's by the numbers does not hold my attention. And while I like I agree with what you're saying, but I felt like in a lot of ways, everything that you're saying about Denzel Washington's performance, and certainly this kind of interesting moment in his career, because I agree with you that this is the moment he's sort of doing this transition.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's enough there. As you said, he's got the one scene with Jennifer Beals, and it's a fantastic scene. It's so fantastic that I think another couple of drafts of this script, they may have had one or two more scenes. Mm. There are details you talk about, the sort of there isn't any detail given to what happened to cause this. But there's not a lot of detail given about a lot of stuff.
Right.
Like just reading about the film, like I found out this afternoon, where like you, obviously this is like my third time watching it. I found out this afternoon there's a plot detail where people go into places and they have to show their hands.
Yeah.
I just read this afternoon that this was a reference to cannibalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that when but it's not a clear connection in the film. Like they talk about it at that, but there's not a clear connection in the film. And I am a careful viewer. Even the twist that we're talking about, like in real time, Dylan and I were talking about the twist and how you can reasonably infer the twist. But there's actually nothing in the script that says that. I mean, look y'all, the movie came out in 2010. The twist is Eli apparently is blind the whole time.
Yes.
And the Bible was in Braille.
Yes.
But even knowing that,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's never a moment in the film where you know, Denzel Washington, you know, they show him listening to things.
They do.
And they talk about him smelling things. But he's very much looking at Mila Kunis when he's talking to her. Like, especially when you contrast that with Jennifer Beals' character, who is also blind,
mm-hmm.
but she's doing like the blind people stuff. Like she's not looking at things and this, that, and the other. So it's not as egregious as like the Sixth Sense, where spoiler, Bruce Willis was a ghost the whole time, but clearly his wife was listening to him when they're on the bench talking to one another. And you're like, oh, M. Night Shyamalan cheated. But it's not as sharp as I wanted to be. And again, for me, I was frustrated because from the moment they go to the house of the cannibals, all the way to the end of the film, there is a bounce.
Mm-hmm.
There is an energy.
I agree.
There is where, okay, the Hughes brothers are doing something different than what people have been doing. Again, for two decades, like we've been making these movies for over two decades. And if you want to count spaghetti westerns, three, four decades. And again, I think everybody in here elevates the material. But frankly, the greatest this is probably a bad example because I love grilled cheese sandwiches, but the greatest grilled cheese sandwich on earth is still going to be a grilled cheese sandwich, no matter how good you make it. And for me, that's what it ended up like. This was the most elevated, middling material, but it's still middling material. And again, today it was very difficult because. You remember when Fury Road came out, like it had gotten to the point I couldn't even, like if Fury Road was on television, I couldn't even turn to it because it mesmerized me.
Okay.
And
I agree.
And so, you know,
it's not trying to do that. It's not mm-hmm. trying to, it's as much as we're talking about the Road Warrior and Mad Max Fury Road. It's not trying to be those movies.
Okay.
It's not. It's trying to be a lot more low key than that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. As far as, you know, the whole twist of him being blind, I think it is there in the script. I think it does it play 100% fair with the audience? Maybe not, but I don't think it does not play fair with the audience. I think it does.
His eyes actually focus when he talks to people.
Yeah, but there are things that you have to pay attention and look at. Like there's a moment when, and I paid attention to it. It was a moment where he comes out and he looks up at the sun, but he doesn't blink at all, mm-hmm. you know, because he can't see the sun. He does feel with his hands. He does like kick forward to like see where he's walking. You do hear him kind of like clicking, trying to do like an echolocation type of thing. You do see these things happening throughout the movie. There are moments where, yes, he is focusing in or looking in the direction of where a voice is coming at him, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's looking them in the eye.
Okay.
You know? So I think it does play fair. There was actually even a moment of where he doesn't respond to somebody who is there until they say something.
Sure.
Because he didn't know who was there.
Right.
And that was something that I thought kind of happened. Mm-hmm. And admittedly, I did read that. And I was like, okay, I kind of thought that happened, but I just mm-hmm. didn't hit rewind. So I think it does play fair, but it doesn't hit you over the head. And hey, a lot of movies aren't going to hit you over the head.
Sure.
With these things. And I appreciate that. I appreciate a movie that you play catch up. And if you're there along the way, it will either add to the experience for you, or maybe it'll detract depending mm-hmm. on how you receive it.
Okay.
But I enjoyed it. And like I said, I am putting the caveat that this is me. I'm not going to say that this is the best Denzel Washington movie of all time.
To give no qualifier for your jam,
but I enjoyed it.
Okay.
That being said, all this being said, Vincent,
mm-hmm.
would you recommend that people see The Book of Eli?
I would not.
Really?
I would not. I think Denzel Washington has done better work.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think everyone in this cast has done better work.
Fair enough.
I think the Hughes brothers have done better work. I think as sort of a post spaghetti Western and as one of these kind of post-apocalyptic films, there are better examples. I do have to say off of the top of my head, like I'm trying to think what is a recent spaghetti. I mean, you know, it's sort of heightened. But I think what's our movie? Netflix, Regina King, and some people I should have named before Regina King.
Oh,
but I love Regina King.
The harder they fall.
I think the harder they fall hits the kind of postmodern spaghetti Western better than this. And you know, and again, I think if you want something that responds to Road Warrior and what Road Warrior sort of sets up as this subgenre, well, George Miller circled back around and showed you what you can do after Road Warrior. So I like the performances. Mm-hmm. I like the direction. I like, but as far as 2 hours to devote to it, I have to land on, I would not recommend it. And you?
I would recommend this film. Okay. I would, to your point about the 2 hours, I don't think it's actually a full 2 hours.
What is it, Lynn? 1 hour and 58 minutes? Like, I think it's 118 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, it didn't feel like it. It didn't feel like it to me. It felt fine time wise. Like, I didn't feel like there was a lot of fat on this movie.
I love this.
So
you know, sometimes, like when Wendy will watch Judge Judy, mm-hmm. and it'll be two black people cases. And I was like, ooh, it's a double black. And like, those are my favorite cases, like the two black people, like, and it doesn't happen that often.
No, it doesn't.
So like, you know, I love the episodes where you like the movie and I don't. Like there's like, I think there've been less than 10 examples of this.
I don't know about that, but anyway.
No, I think there's been less than 10.
That may be true, but yeah. I like this movie. I would recommend it.
Yeah.
I would recommend the movie. I think
you should take Lynn's advice.
I think that it is an opportunity to see Denzel at a different speed.
Okay.
You can never have too much Gary Oldman.
Mm-mm.
Mila Kunis does good work in this. Ray Stevenson, remember you well.
Yeah.
Miss you badly. Mm-hmm. And hey, this is the last film that the Hughes brothers directed together.
Yeah.
They have not directed a film together in 14 years, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. And I think they went out on, to me, a high note.
Now, you know John Boyega is developing a prequel series.
I've heard that with the writer, Gary Whitta, as mm-hmm. executive producer. I like John Boyega. I don't need a prequel series. I don't need a prequel series to.
Well, to my critique, I actually would love to see this fleshed out. So I am cautiously optimistic about that.
Okay.
And God knows I want John Boyega to get a property where he's treated well.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, he hasn't been treated well since, what, Attack on the Block? Attack the Block.
You know, obviously he was fantastic in that episode of Small Axe. And spoiler, I adored him.
Oh.
And they called Tyrone.
They called Tyrone, yeah. Yeah.
They cloned Tyrone.
Yeah. And I'm sure he's still eating off of the Star Wars checks. Even if he may not look at the movies anymore.
Look.
He's still eating off of them checks.
Look.
So
if nothing else, the way they treated him, hopefully them checks still show up every 3 months.
Oh, I bet they do.
Yeah.
Man. I bet they do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's interesting. We are in the second week of mm-hmm. Octavia April, your favorite month of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so far,
I know.
We are.
I know, with one of my favorite acting families.
I know.
Because I love the Washingtons. You know, he took this role because of John David.
Oh, really?
John David brought this to Denzel.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because he said it was his son.
Right.
Brought it to him.
And he said John David told him to take Training Day.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I'm like the interview from around 2010, where obviously John David is a much younger man, where he's saying, you know, my son is getting into films. And so I'm listening to his advice and he brought this to me and I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
So, obviously I like the Washington family, but yeah,
you did not like the creator.
Yeah. Not enough to recommend.
And you did not recommend, you do not recommend The Book of Eli.
I don't.
Yet, however, of the Len Hate subtopic,
yeah,
am one and one
you
here
are.
In Octavia April.
You are.
And next week is my pick.
I mean, that don't mean nothing. Today was my pick.
And that's true. But before we tell you what we're going to be watching next week, ladies
you
and gentlemen.
You pick stuff all the time you'll like.
And I invite you to tell us what you're thinking. What's on your mind? Email us at michaumission@gmail.com. That's michaumission @gmail.com. Let us know what is on your mind. You can always find us on social media, on X, Facebook, as well as on Instagram @michaumission. You can always please subscribe and hit that bell on YouTube. We're a fledgling YouTube channel, but we're trying to get up there, trying to make our way to, I think we're inching closer to 1,500 subscribers, ladies and gentlemen. So tell a friend about the Michaud Mission, the best movie podcast on earth.
On earth.
Yeah, I said it. All right. Which streams every Tuesday live from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace, right here in Manayunk. And if you want to have your podcast filmed here at Yunk Junk, email our man Dylan at yunkjunk.com. That's DYLAN @ yunkjunk.com. The Michaud Mission is also a proud member of The Podglomerate, thepodglomerate.com. They make podcasts work such as ours, which will be back next week. with our next stop in Octavia April, it is my turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I am choosing a film that I believe is from 2021, if I am not mistaken. That is correct. And is written and directed by a person that me and Vincent actually enjoy a great deal from the world of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
John Ridley.
Yes.
Writes and directs Leslie Odom and Cynthia Erivo in Needle in a Time Stack. A lovely piece of Afrofuturism that will be up for review next week here on the Michaud Mission. Until then, he's Vincent, I'm Len, and in parting we say,
we'll see you when it's time to meet again.
The Michaud Mission is produced by Len Webb and Vincent Williams, with co-production by Mo Poplar. Check out Mo's family travel podcast, Bon Amigos, at ashyfeet.com. Original music is provided by Alexa Gold. Visit Alexa Gold Music at Bandcamp for more of her melodies. The Michaud Mission is edited by Len Webb and produced for YouTube at Yunk Junk. Visit Dylan at yunkjunk.com for more information.